You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 9th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme, UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron goes on a US charm offensive, stopping in on Donald Trump ahead of talks on Ukraine and Gaza in Washington, D.C. Then,
Prime Minister Netanyahu, let me say this to you this evening. The Irish people could not be clearer. We are repulsed by your actions. Ceasefire now. And let the aid flow safely.
Ireland's new Taoiseach, Simon Harris, proves he's no stranger to a bold approach. But will that help boost Fine Gael's election hopes? Plus, why Olaf Scholz has joined TikTok and the latest business news too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. Well, since 2016, many world leaders have had to make trips to Florida to visit Donald Trump at his Mar-a-Lago club and residence. The latest to visit the gaudy complex is UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron, stopping off on his way to Washington to drum up support amongst hostile Republicans for further Ukraine funding. For the former Prime Minister, it's somewhat awkward given some of his past criticism of Mr. Trump, but will his notorious charm be able to win over the former president? Joining me now for more on this is Monocle regular and adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin, Scott Lucas. Scott, thank you for joining us. Firstly, do we know how this meeting has gone and what was discussed?
No. And that's quite unusual. The only clue that we have is that David Cameron put out a very brief message about support for Ukraine being vital and standing up to Russia being vital. And of course, the wider context here is that Trumpist and hard-right Republicans since October have held up $60 billion in U.S. aid that would have gone to Kyiv to support its resistance against the 25-month invasion. So I think the working assumption is that Cameron went over to ask Trump to at least try to get his people, his Trumpists, to back off and to allow the aid bill to pass the U.S. House of Representatives, where it's been stalled for quite some time. But that's only an assumption. There was nothing that came out after the meeting from Cameron about what would have been said. And really unusual for me is nothing from Donald Trump. Donald Trump's not a shy guy. Donald Trump loves bragging about when he gets people who visit him in Mar-a-Lago, but not a single photo, not a single statement so far from the presidential candidate.
Very unusual. Donald Trump sort of operates on a quid pro quo basis often. So what could sort of David Cameron have offered him or sort of said to him to try to get him on board with more Ukraine funding?
Well, again, I think that's really kind of a strange point because you're right. You can't offer UK government support for Trump's re-election bid. Even though just simply showing up at Mar-a-Lago, you could say actually gives a bit of a boost to Trump. There's nothing much in terms of what London can put on the table for Trump, which makes me think that Cameron may not have gone over there to try to strike a deal with Trump. It makes me actually think that Cameron went over there for a different reason. I think he may have gone over, and I must emphasize there's just speculation, but I think he may have gone over to give Trump a message about NATO, and to not try to undermine NATO, which we know Trump has done and will try to do again. It's even possible that David Cameron gave Donald Trump a warning with a message on another matter, which is, are you sure you really want to go down here? You want to do this? Donald Trump's in a bit of a compromised position on multiple political and legal fronts. Did David Cameron try to exploit that and try to put Trump on the defensive?
Particularly, as you say, given there was no sort of message or photograph afterwards, it sounds like it could have been a bit of a frosty meeting between the two. But is this a sensible approach from the UK government? They would have obviously run it by Joe Biden's White House first, but to sort of hedge bets with what could happen in November, as you say, with that warning potentially about NATO, given that we had the 75th anniversary summit last week, we've got a summit in Washington, D.C. in the summer. Will that be the number one priority for the UK government to make sure the US stays in that alliance?
I think it definitely is, you know, an attempt to make sure that U.S. agencies, if not Trump, are very much firmly behind NATO. And I think it is part of a wider contingency plan being developed by Europe, specifically with regard to keeping Ukraine bolstered against Russia, but more widely maintaining the alliance despite Trump. We know that contingency planning has now been in place for several months. But I have to emphasize that even if you're talking about contingency planning, trying to contain Trump, how unusual this is. The Foreign Office statement that, you know, a foreign secretary meets opposition candidates in elections and there's nothing unusual about this, that's rubbish. And I hate to be undiplomatic about it, but it's rubbish. William Hague did not meet Mitt Romney in 2012 when he was the opposition candidate against Barack Obama. Boris Johnson is a friend of Donald Trump, but he did not meet Trump in 2016 when Trump was running for president. And Dominic Raab did not meet Joe Biden in 2020 when Biden was the opposition candidate. So this is, you know, I think it's a gamble at the least. Whatever Cameron's doing over there, it is a gamble in terms of if he's trying to appease or woo Trump, that might not work. And if he's trying to send a message to challenge Trump, well, we're not sure that will work either.
Just one thing you mentioned there, you talked about sort of containment of Trump and contingency. I mean, in 2016, it very much felt as though, and then in the next few years, it did play out like this, that the morning after, Angela Merkel was effectively the sort of new leader of the free world. And at multiple summits, be they G20s or G7s, she was the one that sort of tried to keep things on track. I mean, looking at the leadership around the world now, is there anyone sort of strong enough or middleable enough to keep things going if Trump does get in and to try and kind of win him over somewhat?
I think the really positive side is that we're not actually looking at trying to just galvanize and put all our hopes on a single person, say like an Emmanuel Macron in France, certainly not like an Olaf Scholz in Germany. Instead, what you've had is very much the European Union in particular working together and NATO working together in recent months. So to give you one very high profile example, it's the European Union that finally overcame the resistance of Vladimir Putin's ally, Viktor Orban of Hungary, to get 50 billion euros of aid approved for Ukraine through 2027. And on top of that, with Ukraine facing a serious shortage of artillery shells, it's the Europeans who have put together a coalition to deliver hundreds of thousands of shells to Ukraine this year, while the U.S. is paralyzed by the Trumpist. And I'm not going to say that that is going to be all that Ukraine needs. I think we still would like to see a breakthrough in Washington. But I think Europe has stepped up. It has stepped up in providing that support for Kyiv and sending the message to Russia that even as we know in the last 24 hours about the latest Russian political warfare campaign through hundreds of thousands of fake messages inside the U.S. and in Europe, that you will not break us, even if your boy Donald Trump wins the U.S. election.
Mm. One thing, though, we know that Trump always tends to remember slights. He's all about personal relationships, and he proves that he did come to love dictators during his last term in office. I mean, in 2015, David Cameron said that Mr. Trump's proposed ban on Muslims entering the U.S. was divisive, stupid, and wrong. There are lots of world leaders who've made comments about Donald Trump over the years since he's been out of office. Do you think he'll have kept a log of those, and he might sort of bring them up when he has these meetings again, if he does get back into power?
Oh, yeah. Trump never forgets a slight. And in fact, in the last 24 hours, he's gone after one of his former allies, Lindsey Graham, over the abortion issue in the United States. That's why I think that beyond Trump keeping a list and what might happen if he does get into power, that's what makes this so unusual in terms of, well, the candidate who hasn't barked yet, that Donald Trump has not said a word about whether or not he was pressured by David Cameron or whether David Cameron came over and tried to win his favor. I do think that Donald Trump tries to get people on his side. Boris Johnson declared him unfit for office a few months later. Boris Johnson was effectively aided by Donald Trump on his path to becoming prime minister. I don't think that'll happen this time with David Cameron. I think we're talking about a make or break moment between Trump and the Europeans. I'm just not quite sure how this visit fits in yet.
And just finally, what kind of reception do you think that David Cameron will have when he does go to Washington, D.C.? I mean, last time Marjorie Taylor Greene told him to kiss her ass when he was there trying to lobby for support for Ukraine and also for them sort of putting more pressure on Israel. Is there any sort of shifting of the grounds there?
Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to simply be Marjorie Taylor Greene. Given that she's a supporter of the conspiracy theorist QAnon, I think that the substance of David Cameron's meetings are going to be the adults are in the room when he talks to the Biden administration, in particular Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. And if the media focuses on the adults being in the room on important matters, whether it's China, the Middle East, whether it's Ukraine and Russia, then this will be a productive visit. If the media gets led astray because some fringe elements like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz or some other Trumpist wants to try to steal the news cycle, then the U.S. media will be doing a disservice to this important meeting, these very important meetings that are being held at a critical moment for Ukraine, for the Middle East, and for the rest of the world.
Scott Lucas, thank you. Now here's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a date was set for an invasion of Rafah, Gaza's last refuge for displaced Palestinians. Meanwhile, Nicaragua has brought Germany before the ICJ to demand that judges impose emergency measures to stop Berlin from providing Israel with weapons and other assistance. Russia and China have agreed to discuss ways to deepen security cooperation across Europe and Asia to counter US influence after its foreign ministers met yesterday in Beijing. China and Russia declared a no-limits partnership in February 2022 when President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing just days before he sent tens of thousands of troops into Ukraine. And the trial of 27 people charged in connection with the Panama Papers money laundering scandal has begun. The leak of secret financial documents in 2016 revealed how some of the world's wealthiest people stashed their assets in offshore companies. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Paige. And now for some business news with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, some data on lending in the euro area. How will that feed into the thinking on interest rates?
Vincent, yeah, Thursday is interest rate decision day for the European Central Bank. Now, we're not expecting a cut in rates at this week's meeting, but we have some interesting data out today, which will feed into their thinking for the next meeting. It's from the ECB's own quarterly bank lending survey. They say that demand for loans from the corporate sector saw a substantial decline in the first 3 months of the year as European companies continue to face the cost of elevated borrowing costs. There was actually a moderate easing in mortgage lending conditions. It's the first time that that's happened since the end of 2021. But we all know we're facing much higher interest rates than we were a couple of years ago. Now, the market widely expects the deposit rate in the euro area, currently 4%, to be cut at the June meeting. That's the one after this. The ECB itself has almost said as much in as many words. The market is pretty certain that we're going to get that rate cut coming in June. The European economy has been pretty flat over the last year or so, and it does seem that inflation is under control. That is at least the hope of central bankers. Interesting to contrast the experience with the United States. At the beginning of the year, the markets were certain we were going to get three cuts from the Fed, at least three cuts from the Fed, and they would come pretty quickly. That's one of the things which drove the stock market up so much over the last few months of last year and at the beginning of this year. But now markets are starting to dial back on those expectations for US interest rate cuts. Many people in the markets now think there will just be two cuts this year. The Fed is still saying it's likely to be three. But of course, with the US election coming as well, that's also going to cloud the outlook for the Federal Reserve. So lots of people starting to think that US interest rates are not going to be cut quite as soon as we thought, because the US economy is just really motoring along.
And there's more detail on where the US government is directing its big chip making subsidies.
Yeah, this is all about the US Chips and Science Act. It's President Biden's big effort to boost domestic production of critical technology. The legislation set aside a whopping $39 billion in direct grants and loans and guarantees worth another $75 billion to persuade semiconductor companies to build their factories in the US after decades of shifting production abroad. We've just had a bit more detail on where some of that money is going to go. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC, is going to get $6.5 billion in grants and $5 billion in loans. to help the world's top chip maker to build factories in Arizona. Now, under this preliminary agreement, TSMC is going to conduct a third factory in Phoenix. It's already got two on the way. They're going to begin production in 2025 and 2028. This latest site is going to make the most recent next generation 2-nanometer chips. This is all very clever stuff. The US Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo says that for the first time ever, going to be making at scale the most advanced semiconductor chips on the planet right here in the United States. But I think it's probably fair to say that this is the US is not the only country playing this game. Lots of countries want these chip factories, and a lot of countries are putting a lot of money into this.
Ewan Potts, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And now to Ireland, where today Simon Harris officially becomes the country's youngest Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, following former leader Leo Varadkar's surprise resignation announcement last month. Nicknamed the TikTok Taoiseach, there's hope from within his own party, Fine Gael, that he may be able to bolster their popularity amongst the youth at upcoming elections. Joining me now for more on this is Irish journalist Ciara Kelly. Ciara, you're very welcome. Firstly, for those who haven't heard of Simon Harris, how would you describe him and his career thus far?
Simon would be, he's going to be our youngest ever Taoiseach. He's due to be voted in, and he does look like he has a comfortable majority and will be elected Taoiseach in about 20 minutes time. He is somebody who is a career politician. He entered the Dáil at the age of 24, the Dáil being our parliament, and he is someone who has had a reasonably meteoric, I suppose, climb up through the ranks of Fine Gael. It is somewhat unsurprising, I think, that he is becoming Taoiseach and the leader of Fine Gael. He has always been tipped to end up in that position. And I suppose if there were any true criticisms of it, of him, it would be that perhaps there is more style than substance. When people describe Simon and talk about how good he is, they say he's a great speaker, he's a great communicator, rather than, I think, you know, that he has any particular policy or substance-driven issues that people associate with him.
And I remember interviewing him back in 2018 during the referendum on abortion in Ireland. He was only sort of 30 then, and he was the health minister. He has sort of done big jobs in governments, though, hasn't he? He's got a bit of experience behind him, hasn't he?
Oh, no, he absolutely has. As I say, he's 37. He will be our youngest Taoiseach, and he entered the Dáil at 24. He was made health minister, and that is one of the biggest, obviously, departments in government, at the age of 29. There have been criticisms levelled at him that within the departments that he has helmed, that he hasn't achieved necessarily what he set out to do. But he's not a particularly unpopular politician. I mean, certainly in his own constituency, I actually live in his constituency, he would be considered very popular. And he has a something that would be have been ascribed to a previous Taoiseach here, Bertie Ahern, a kind of a Teflon sort of a veneer about him in that very little seems to stick to him by way of criticism. And he manages to navigate things like social media, which hence the TikTok Taoiseach moniker. He seems to do those things quite well.
That is a good warm-up tongue twister, isn't it? But he's been described often in lots of profiles I've seen as a man in a hurry, obviously, with his age. He is in a hurry, though, because you've got elections next year, and the polling looks as though Sinn Féin, for the first time, would be looking to form the government in Dublin. Is his sort of approach, you've mentioned already, he's a great communicator and he's on, you know, social media a lot. Is that, you know, sort of link to millennial younger voters at all going to do anything to help his party's fortunes in the next 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, we have to have an election by the end of next March. And there is some, you know, lots of views out there as to when it might be. Some people think it will be actually in the autumn. Some people think that Simon Harris as Taoiseach will hold on for as long as possible before he goes to the polls. Sinn Féin have considerably better, I suppose, penetration on social media than any other political party here. They've done extremely well on social media. And Fine Gael will be slightly on the back foot as compared to them in terms of dealing with that. Fine Gael, are lower in the polls, considerably lower than Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin have done extremely well. They were the most popular party at the last election, but they didn't manage to form a coalition, which is why we currently have Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party coalition. But Sinn Féin have struggled over the last number of months in particular. Their popularity has waned somewhat. They've flip-flopped a little bit on our hate speech legislation that's been wending its way through the parliament. They've flip-flopped a little bit on immigration. And they look less sure of their footing now at almost any time since the 2020 election. And I don't think it is quite as much of a given as it was maybe up until now that the next Taoiseach would be female and would be Mary Lou MacDonald. But of course, you can't rule that out either. Mm.
I want to come back to those issues you just mentioned, actually, in a moment. But first of all, something that struck out over the weekend, most countries in Europe, particularly of their centre-right, as the sort of Irish government is, are normally kind of supportive of Israel. But over the weekend, there's been quite a direct statement from your new prime minister to Benjamin Netanyahu, criticising him directly and calling for immediate ceasefire. Ireland has sort of been one of the toughest in Europe and in the West on Israel over the past 6 months. Is that course set to continue, do you think?
Yes, I do think. There is widespread popular support for our government holding a reasonably pro-Palestinian position here, and that has always been the way. I think Ireland as a country sort of identifies with the nationhood of Palestine and the Palestinians, largely probably to do with our own kind of colonial past with regard to the UK, who may not like me to compare them in any way to Israel. But I think the Irish people do identify with the Palestinians quite strongly, and there is certainly a reasonably widespread pro-Palestinian mindset here. I think that will continue. There are interesting shifts here in politics. Fine Gael has often been referred to as a centre-right party, but if you actually drill down into their policies, they're probably more centre or centre-left, in fact, than centre-right, but they are to the right of many other parties here, which we would have a largely left of centre Dáil. So that's why they are considered right wing, even though they're not particularly to the right. But we are seeing some pushback here. Housing is probably the biggest issue that voters are concerned about currently. We have a great difficulty, and we have a whole generation as referred to as generation rent here.
Mm. But equally, a sort of hangover from the 2008 financial crisis and the bubble bursting there. Yeah. So is that Simon Harris's sort of top matter now?
That's probably the biggest thing. But we do have an issue with migration. Migration is increasingly something that appears to be concerning the electorate. It's probably maybe the third item on the electorate's agenda: housing, health, and then migration. And I don't think the government is exactly sure of their footing about what they want to do about that currently. They are tightening our migration rules. Up until now, we've had a reasonably free movement and some people would say freer than other countries within the EU movement of people, and a kind of more open asylum seeking process. But that is definitely tightening up. It's hard to know what way. I mean, obviously, you mentioned Europe, lots of countries swinging to the right in Europe. Whether or not Ireland is going to become slightly more conservative now here is something that is being debated quite widely.
And over the past decade, a lot of European nations have had sort of the rise of the sort of, not far right, but the sort of quite right parties, particularly on this immigration issue. Ireland has sort of been late to this, but in the last few years, you've obviously had a huge number of refugees or people being taken in from Ukraine. You've had other movement, and it's put a pressure on the systems that probably hasn't been experienced before that's led to this backlash. We saw the sort of riots in Dublin last year. We've seen hotels that have been attacked where immigrants have been housed. How is Simon Harris promising to tackle this issue? Is that just always coming back to this issue of not enough housing, really?
Yeah, I think housing definitely feels into an anti-immigrant sentiment that was sort of very much a fringe element for a long time, and then it became more of a burgeoning movement, and now has moved far more mainstream. What was probably considered maybe even 12 months ago, even maybe 6 months ago, the proviso of far right elements has become something that, as I say, more moderate, more centrist and more mainstream electoral and political concerns are kind of focusing on. The news organization that I work for is actually expecting a far right protest outside our doors a little bit later on today. We've been warned around that. So there does seem to be a movement that is partly a far right fueled thing, but equally that issue around migration has sort of moved from the sort of the fringe element into much more mainstream and is now something that is being widely debated by more centrists and more mainstream parties, because the electorate, I think, is probably fair to say, demanding some kind of a debate around all of it.
Well, I hope there's not too much trouble outside of your studios. Keira Kelly, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has become the latest leader to join TikTok in order to try to connect and communicate with younger voters. The new official government account promises to give a look behind the scenes of everyday government life, but the embattled Chancellor has pledged not to do any dances. He follows in the footsteps of Presidents Joe Biden and Emmanuel Macron, taking to the Chinese-owned app despite widespread security concerns and worries over disinformation. Clotilde Goujard is a senior technology reporter for Politico in Brussels. Clotilde, thank you for joining us. Mr. Scholz happens to be making a visit to China this week. Is that why he's made this leap onto TikTok now?
Well, that's unclear. That's not what he's said himself, but the timing is particularly interesting, I would say, especially because Germany is one of the European Union countries that has wanted to keep its economic ties to China the most, I would say.
And in terms of the opportunities for him, I mean, he's struggling in the polls at the moment. What could he do on the app, do you think, to turn things around?
Well, his party, as well as other more central mainstream parties, have so far not taken over the app. And so they've left the space to far-right politicians and far-right narratives. And so ahead of major elections, including the European Parliament elections, Olaf Scholz has a lot of catching up to do, especially since some of the other opponents and the AfD, so the far-right party in Germany, have reached like millions of followers. So it's unclear if this new social media outreach will translate into votes, but at least he will be able to share his strategy and his message on the platform that is used by over 125 million European users.
And what kind of content have the AfD been putting on the platform that's been gaining them a following?
Well, the AfD, as much as other European far-right parties, have been trying to speak to the youth and really use similar strategies that we see on TikTok. Not so much dances, but memes, are trying to not always speak about politics, but do it in a sort of funny way. You know, make fun of other leaders, but using hashtags or viral trends, things like this. Some of their messages have been more outwardly political. But the thing that works for them, I would say, is that an app like TikTok, like a lot of other social media platforms, works very well with these sort of content that's either kind of funny or that has a very strong radical message, because it is more easily amplified because it creates strong reactions from people who see it.
And several governments around the world have deep concerns about TikTok and its very close ties with the Chinese government. There are accusations that it has spread disinformation and that it's also putting out the world narrative that China would like other countries to adopt. Countries like the US, for instance, and the UK ban the app on government devices. What is Germany's security position on the app?
Germany has followed in the same direction, similarly to all of the European Union. Last year, basically, a whole lot of governments, including the European Union institutions, decided that because of the risk to security, including data security and tracking, it would be safer to tell officials to uninstall, delete their apps from their work phones and devices. And so that's exactly what the government in Germany has done. And this is still the case for now. The ban hasn't been lifted for government officials. What we've seen, at least in Brussels and in other European countries, is that in order to appeal to voters while using the platform, some politicians have basically taken another device, let's say a burner phone. That might be a bit extreme, but you know, a secondhand phone that is not connected to any of their other apps or work emails and things like that.
And President Biden recently raised concerns about the ownership of the platform with Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. I mean, do you think we're getting to the point now where governments have decided, OK, this isn't going away, we have to engage with it in order to reach millennials and Gen Z, but we also still want to put pressure on China to sell it off somehow?
That's what we're seeing in the US, and that's largely because the US has had a more confrontational and adversarial approach to China. So it's part of their internal politics. And the other thing is that the US doesn't have its own data protection or privacy legislation, meaning that TikTok over there can hover all of the data it wants and send it straight to China if it wants to. Whereas this is quite different in Europe, in the UK, and in the European Union because of regulation like the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. So this is quite different. And then Europe has been not as confrontational with China. So I think so far what we're seeing is a similar direction and realization that there are risks attached to TikTok because of its Chinese parent, ByteDance. However, the US has gone in a much stronger way with this bill that could potentially be adopted and that would force ByteDance, the Chinese parent company of TikTok, to sell off TikTok or else be banned.
And just finally, when Theresa May was at her most trouble as prime minister here, she ended up dancing on stage to ABBA. Do you think we might see Olaf Scholz break his promise and end up dancing to try and get people interested in him at some point?
It's hard to say. I'm not part of his cabinet nor his communication advisor. I'm not sure he would do that. I haven't seen that many other European politicians do exactly that. I think if he were smart, he would just probably take on other types of trends that might make him look still serious and not too cringe. Otherwise, he might lose a few young voters over there.
Clotilde, thank you. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin. And our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.